the top stories. The Kremlin says Russian President Vladimir Putin will host his Iranian counterpart Ebrahim Raisi in Moscow on Wednesday as the two countries seek to deepen their ties. Tehran's ambassador to the UN says despite U.S. sanctions, Iran has broken new grounds with regard to empowerment of women and girls. So in the headlines, in the UK, pressure piles up on the embattled Prime Minister after up to 20 more members of his own party plan to submit letters of no confidence in Boris Johnson. And those were the top stories. Welcome. Russia says President Vladimir Putin will host his Iranian counterpart in Moscow on Wednesday as the two countries move to further enhance relations in the economic, political, and cultural domains. The Kremlin says Putin and Ebrahim Raisi will discuss a whole range of cooperation topics, including the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Iran and Russia have described the visit as an important milestone in their relations. Raisi also plans to address the State Duma. Iran's oil, foreign, and economy ministers will accompany Raisi on his two-day visit to Russia. In an article on Russia's Sputnik News website, the Iranian foreign minister hailed Moscow's positive steps aimed at the removal of sanctions on Iran. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Russia has had an effective and constructive role in both the signing of the JCPOA and the ongoing talks on the removal of sanctions imposed by the U.S. Journalist and political commentator Fred Ware says Russia has realized that developing relations with countries like Iran and China is much more rewarding than ties with the West.
But after 2014, when the front of sanctions against Russia occurred and these geopolitical tensions started to spike, Russia realized that doing business with the West was fraught with all kinds of difficulties, whereas when you turn east, you find friendly countries that don't pour all kinds of human rights conditions into your negotiations, and you can do business. So that has happened with China in a big way. I think we can expect it to happen with Iran as well. I think that beyond the JCPOA, the subtext that will be discussed is a whole range of things, including trade, arms sales, and many other, tendencies toward warming relations, deeper ties. I think that that's what we can look forward to in these talks.
Diplomatic efforts are ongoing in the Austrian capital, Vienna, to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. This is the eighth round of talks between Iran and the P4+1 group of countries, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany. The U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the agreement in 2018 and is not directly involved in the talks. Homa Lesgi has been closely following the developments in Vienna earlier. She joined us with an update.
So the Russian and the Chinese positions throughout these talks have been in support of Iran's demands for verification and guarantees from the Americans because of what happened under the Trump administration. They believe that the American administration was wrong and committed an illegal act by withdrawing from the JCPOA, which is supported by the UN Security Council Resolution 2231. And now they believe because the Trump administration made that mistake and violated the deal, it should be the American side that comes back to the JCPOA first. Iran has been saying it wants the verified effective removal of sanctions before it goes back to its nuclear commitments. But it looks like there are still some questions or some outstanding issues when it comes to sanctions lifting, also when it comes to sequencing, when it comes to nuclear commitments. So all the important areas that these talks are focused on do have their outstanding issues, according to sources close to the talks. But they are saying that we're in the process of wording everything or drafting it, and they're still, at least the Russians say, they're still optimistic and that they believe a deal is possible. Even we know the European High Representative, Joseph Borrell, said that he believes an agreement can be reached. As to when it can happen, that's the main question, because, of course, the Americans and the Westerners have said they would prefer this to happen within weeks. In fact, they've said if it doesn't happen soon enough, then they would rather have the JCPOA collapse totally. But Iran says if they are willing to remove the sanctions in a verifiable manner, then it is actually possible to do this if they are willing to give the guarantees and verification that Iran is asking for a credible sanctions lifting.
Iran says it has made significant achievements in the empowerment of women and girls in the face of sanctions imposed on the Islamic Republic. Iran's UN ambassador, Majid Takhter Avanchi, says the U.S.'s sanctions not only violate international law, but also breach the basic rights of girls and women. He made the remarks during a UN Security Council meeting on women, peace and security. Takhter Avanchi also touched on the situation of women in West Asia. He expressed dismay over the destructive effects of occupation and foreign intervention, as well as terrorist activities targeting girls and women in the region. He said the oldest case for such impairment would be Palestinian women, who continue to suffer the consequences of decades of occupation and human rights violations. A British journalist says up to 20 new Conservative Party lawmakers plan to submit letters of no confidence in Prime Minister Boris Johnson. A Daily Telegraph journalist wrote about the decision in a Twitter post. The move could mean the 54 letters required for a confidence vote to be held on the Prime Minister is reached. Johnson's been lately hit by a series of scandals, including violations of coronavirus lockdown restrictions. The Premier's former aide has now accused him of lying to Parliament about a Downing Street party during a national lockdown in 2020. Last week, the leader of the opposition Labour Party demanded Johnson quit for hosting what critics label as parties, but he calls work events. After a national weekend of action across Britain against the proposed new law that would give police extra powers to curb protests, the upper chamber of the country's parliament has introduced multiple amendments to it. While campaigners have welcomed the charges, they still consider the proposed legislation as an attack on their civil liberties and are calling for it to be thrown out. Saeed Purazai is in London.
The right to assemble, to demonstrate, to be heard, a cornerstone of democracy, potentially under threat in proposed UK government legislation that gives the police sweeping new powers.
It does actually, in their opinion, violate civil liberties, existing civil liberties of society. And of course, with the backdrop of COVID and the draconian measures, and on the back of 20 years of increased police powers after the anti-terrorism laws, etc., that have come in to counter terrorism, there's a sort of nervousness.
And here is why it matters. Women being manhandled and handcuffed by police for attending a peaceful vigil held last year in the wake of 33-year-old Sarah Everard's murder at the hands of a police officer.
While the Conservative government claims the bill is aimed at proactively preventing chaos and disruption caused, for example, by people who glue their faces to motorways, its critics say the bill is not about law and order, but about taking away their right to protest.
The proposed legislation was quickly pushed through the House of Commons last year. This week it was put up for debate at the upper chamber of the UK Parliament, amid cries of kill the bill from drum-beating protesters forming an emotive backdrop to it outside the legislative body. What ensued was several amendments made to the proposed legislation to the chagrin of the government.
There is a general trend for government to grab more and more power and to reduce civil liberties. This is what's worrying. I think that the Lords ultimately, as you say, won't be able to stop it entirely. They can slow the process down, water it down slightly. But if governments are inexorably marching towards a greater totalitarian-orientated set of legislature, then I'm afraid that at the moment, with the climate the way it is, politically, economically, etc., I don't think it'll be terribly difficult for them to push it through.
Campaigners say the parliamentary defeat came because people took to the streets and raised the alarm about the government's growing authoritarianism. They say it is now time to build the movement and kill the contentious bill once and for all. Saeed Purazza, London.
Saudi Arabia carries out fresh airstrikes on the Yemeni capital Sana'a and several other cities across the country. The Saudi-led coalition targeted the airport in various neighborhoods across the capital Sana'a with over a dozen air raids. The attacks come within a day after the coalition targeted Sana'a with similar air raids, killing at least 20 people, Saudi warplanes also conducted airstrikes on Ma'ari province, killing 5 civilians there, including 2 children. Saudi Arabia has ramped up its attacks on Yemen in recent weeks. The Yemeni army has struck targets inside the United Arab Emirates in what's seen as its largest attack so far against the Sheikhdom. The army is calling it a retaliation for the UAE's role in the years-long war. It came a day after the Saudi-led coalition carried out dozens of airstrikes that led to more than a dozen civilian casualties. And it's exactly this aspect, the human cost of war, that is not receiving the importance that it should.
On Monday, the Yemeni army conducted retaliatory strikes on several targets in the United Arab Emirates. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the country launched 5 ballistic missiles and a large number of drones at Dubai and Abu Dhabi airports, an oil refinery in Musafa, and several other sensitive and important sites in the UAE. Local officials said 3 people were killed and 6 others injured after 3 fuel tanker trucks exploded in the storage facility of an Emirati oil firm in the Musafa area. Fires erupted in the Abu Dhabi International Airport, disrupting flights. This came just days after the Yemeni army repelled an attack by Emirati-backed mercenaries in the province of Ma'arib, killing and injuring dozens. In a statement, the Yemeni army said Monday's attack inside the UAE was a warning to stop its involvement in the Saudi-led war on the country. The army warned the coalition of more painful attacks if it continues its aggression against Yemen.
Just because it is possible to bully or invade a country with little resistance, such as the cases with Yemen and Saudi Arabia and the UAE, doesn't mean that it should be done, and that countries have more of a responsibility to each other and the international community than they do to their own immediate self-gain. I had the privilege of attending many protests in favor of Yemen and protests to stop the bombing and the harassment of Yemen when I was in New York City. And you can see this is a genuine movement. This is so many people from all different walks of life are recognizing the horrors that are being committed against Yemen by Saudi Arabia, by the backed UAE, and it has to come to an end.
The Yemeni military has warned that the UAE won't withstand its future strikes.
The UAE joined the Saudi-led coalition in 2015 to start a war on behalf of Yemen's ousted regime. 4 years later, it claimed that it had withdrawn from the war, but there is evidence to suggest that it is still actively engaged, especially in the battle for control of the oil-producing Ma'arib province. Not only that, the UAE is also involved with Israel in Yemen's south to secure the strategically located and mineral-rich Socotra Island, reportedly turning it into a spy and intelligence center for the Israeli Air Force.
Earlier this week, Yemen said Saudi Arabia had once again seized a ship carrying much-needed fuel while en route to the country's Hodeidah port. Yemeni officials said the vessel had secured UN clearances to enter Yemen, but it was diverted to the Saudi coast of Jizan. Saudi Arabia has seized several Yemeni-bound fuel ships in recent months, despite an ongoing fuel crisis there. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel that had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The United Nations, however, called on Yemen to return the ship. It also condemned the country's recent retaliatory strikes on the UAE and called for all sides to exercise maximum restraint. It made no mention of the Saudi-led coalition's deadly strikes on Yemen.
And the United Nations has no right to demand that this UAE flagship be returned so it can go back into combat and slaughter goodness knows how many more innocent Yemeni civilians. And so I think that, I mean, Yemen should stand strong. The international community, the anti-imperialist international community, should stand strong with Yemen and say absolutely not. Unless the UN is going to play fair and be neutral, and in this case be supportive of Yemen and the right to defense, then the UN has no business saying what should and should not be done in this conflict with the UAE.
Saudi Arabia and its allies have maintained a tight blockade on Yemen, where the population is in dire need of basic supplies such as food and medicine. Riyadh imposed a blockade in 2015, the same year that it launched an air campaign on Yemen. Daily airstrikes have hit the country, leaving tens of thousands of Yemenis dead. The attacks have increased in recent weeks. Almost 7 years after the war started, and despite all the hardships the Arab country is enduring, the Yemeni retaliatory attacks are driving home the message that the Yemenis are not backing down until the aggression against their nation is ended.
Iran says Saudi blockade and bombings are not the solution to the crisis in Yemen, and that they actually only lead to more tensions in the region. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says Iran constantly supports an initiative to reach that as a political settlement for ending the crisis in Yemen. Khatibzadeh noted that Iran backs any solution that guarantees the territorial integrity of Yemen. He also stressed that the Islamic Republic is ready to assist in any initiative that would lead to the end of the seven-year Saudi-led war on the country. And that's it with international news. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Data shows violent attacks from right-wing groups in the United States are significantly more prevalent than from left-wing or international or extremist terrorist groups. A report also found that right-wing extremists perpetrated two-thirds of the attacks and plots in the United States in 2019, and over 90% between 1st of January and 8th of May 2020. We now present you an article written jointly by Sergio Olmos and Martin Pengeli. The piece is titled, Top U.S. Democrat Warns Recruitment of Veterans by Extremists May Increase. top U.S. lawmaker who heads a congressional committee investigating the targeting of veterans by extremist groups has warned that the problem is a serious one and could get bigger unless it is effectively combated. In an interview with The Guardian, Mark Takano, a Democratic congressman from California, said he was concerned about the recruiting strategy being deployed by violent right-wing extremist groups, especially in America's increasingly fraught political climate in the wake of the 6th of January attack on the U.S. Capitol. Mark Takano is the chairman of the House Veteran Affairs Committee, which has begun hearings into the rising threat to veterans. The first of three hearings occurred in October of last year, but Takano has been concerned about the threat for years. Mark Takano said, "Targeting of veterans by violent extremist groups is a problem, and it could become a bigger problem if we don't understand what's involved and the dimensions of it." Takano said the issue was bipartisan, and the definition of extremism did not favor liberal or conservative. He said, "We define extremism not by the content of the ideology of the group, but whether a group espouses, advocates, endorses, or promotes violence as a way to achieve their ends." But he was clear the current threat of veteran recruitment comes more from the extremist right. Mark Takano said, "We are seeing that this violence is occurring at a far greater degree among right-wing groups, especially within the last 6 years." He claimed, "As far as we can tell, right-wing extremist groups are the ones targeting veterans for recruitment, and there's not really any evidence that we're seeing that left-wing groups are targeting veterans." Data shows violent attacks from right-wing groups in the United States are significantly more prevalent than from left-wing or international or extremist terrorist groups. An analysis by the Center for International Strategic Studies, a nonpartisan think tank, looked at 893 terrorist plots and attacks in the United States between January of 1994 and May of 2020. It found that far-right terrorism has significantly outpaced terrorism from other types of perpetrators, including from far-left networks and individuals inspired by Daesh terrorists or Al-Qaeda terrorists. The report also found that right-wing extremists perpetrated two-thirds of the attacks and plots in the United States in 2019 and over 90% between 1st of January and 8th of May 2020. The 738 defendants charged in the 6th of January attack on the Capitol include 81 individuals with ties to the military, while 5 were active duty service members. Air Force veteran Ashley Babbitt was shot dead by police while attempting to break into the House chamber. Recently, 3 retired Army generals wrote an opinion editorial in the Washington Post warning of the threat of a coup in the 2024 U.S. election, saying it could succeed with the aid of rogue military elements. Mark Takano's committee conducted its first hearing in October. Takano said, "We looked into how and why veterans were being recruited by violent extreme groups. At the history and the track record of groups like the Proud Boys, 3% Militia, Oath Keepers, Boogaloo Boys and others." Takano said extremist groups see an advantage in having veterans in their ranks. He said, "In that sense, they are a greater target for recruitment than non-veteran Americans." Chairman of the House Veteran Affairs Committee, Mark Takano, described friction in addressing the problem among some Republican lawmakers on his committee. Takano said, "At least 2 members wouldn't even engage the subject." He added, "When it came for their turn, they didn't ask the witnesses any questions, including the witness that was chosen by the Republican team. He said, the two Republican members instead just used their 5 minutes to attack me for holding the hearing. Takano sees the issues that leave veterans vulnerable to extremism as being the same as for the general population. He said, the things that contribute to veterans being vulnerable are the same things that affect all Americans. Social isolation, addictions, mental health issues, and emotional trauma. He added, we need to recognize that there is a problem that we have politically motivated violent extremist groups that are targeting veterans. We need to look at ways that we can protect veterans. The Department of Justice said on Thursday, 13th of January, Stuart Rhodes, the founder and leader of the far-right Oath Keepers militia group, has been arrested and charged with seditious conspiracy in the 6th of January attack on the U.S. Capitol. 10 other individuals face the same charge, which carries a maximum penalty of 20 years in prison. Announcing the first seditious conspiracy charges brought in connection with the Capitol attack, the Justice Department said members of the extremist group came to Washington intent on stopping the certification of Joe Biden's victory over Donald Trump in the presidential election. Stuart Rhodes, a 56-year-old from Granbury, Texas, is the highest-ranking member of any extremist group to be arrested in relation to the attack. The Justice Department said Stuart Rhodes and Edward Vallejo, a 63-year-old from Phoenix, Arizona, were being charged for the first time in connection with events leading up to and including 6th of January. Stuart Rhodes was arrested recently in Little Elm, Texas, and Edward Vallejo was arrested in Phoenix, Arizona. The 9 others already faced charges in connection with the Capitol attack, among more than 725 individuals to do so. In a statement, the Justice Department described the Oath Keepers as a large but loosely organized collection of individuals, some of whom are associated with far-right militias. The statement said, though the Oath Keepers will accept anyone as member, they explicitly focus on recruiting current and former military, law enforcement, and first responder personnel. Members and affiliates of the Oath Keepers were among the individuals and groups who forcibly entered the Capitol on 6th of January 2021. Stuart Rhodes, the founder and leader of the Oath Keepers, did not enter the Capitol, but is accused of helping put into motion violence that disrupted the certification process. Thousands of pro-Trump rioters stormed past police barriers and smashed windows, entering the Capitol building, injuring dozens of police officers and sending lawmakers into hiding. 5 people died in the attack, including a Capitol police officer and a Trump supporter shot by law enforcement. Some in the mob erected a gallows outside the Capitol. Some chanted, "Hang Mike Pence," as they searched for the vice president who was presiding over the certification process. Mike Pence rejected pressure from Donald Trump and his advisors, who said it was within his power to block the certification process, citing unfounded claims of electoral fraud in battleground states and throw the election to the U.S. House. Scenes from the attack on the Capitol were broadcast around the world. The Justice Department release described one of the most indelible moments. At approximately 2:30 p.m. local time on 6th of January 2021, it said, some of the men now charged with seditious conspiracy and other Oath Keepers and affiliates, many wearing paramilitary clothing and patches with the Oath Keepers' name, logo and insignia, marched in a stack formation up the east steps of the Capitol, joined the mob, and made their way into the Capitol. Later, another group of Oath Keepers and associates formed a second stack and breached the Capitol grounds, marching from the west side to the east side of the Capitol building and up the east stairs and into the building.
food for thought.
Hello, everyone, and let us ponder on the means of intercession with him by Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, the Immaculate Daughter of the Almighty's last messenger to God, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. I will intercede for the sinners from among the Ummah of my Father when I am raised on the Day of Judgment.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
قضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity. سيد عبد الله الموسوي.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, especially when we look at his justice. Now, one interesting fact that happened during the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam is that there were many hypocrites at the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi who resorted to new devices every now and then to protect the means of their lives and of their enjoyment and pleasures, and to keep the indigenous person enslaved. They used to use various weapons in remote as well as in the near past to achieve these ends. The main weapon, however, that was used by them was the wrong interpretation of religious orders. This policy has not been peculiar to the Muslims. It has, you know, been adopted by all hypocrites claiming to be to profess Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So nothing new there. The most simple weapon of which the hypocrites took advantage of was their claim that prophets have invited people to be, you know, mystical in a way, to abstain from indulging in desires. Instead of, you know, seeking worldly matter, they should remain poor, and they should, you know, prefer indigenous and poverty over trying to, you know, work and make an effort. So they managed to mislead people into how a person should live by saying, you know what, a mu'min, a believer, should live a life of poverty, a life of simplicity, a life of abstaining from all these kind of desires. And they got away with it, where most people said, well, yeah, that makes sense, because I'm going to heaven, so why should I care about the worldly matter? By such a concept, they stole and deprived their sustenance from them. Now, the hypocrites gave much publicity to their, obviously, their views that we just mentioned, and desires that the common man should accept them as correct, because that's how much they were publicized on the pulpits, on Friday sermons, by the scholars who work for these corrupt governments, so that the orders may remain, so that others may remain deprived, and they themselves may continue to be rich and enjoy the pleasures of life. The king is getting richer and the poor is getting poorer. The only difference is the poor is thinking he is doing something for the sake of Allah, and the wealthy is saying, what fools. It is necessary that to counterattack their false propaganda, we should clarify the true position. Not only by doing so that we can find out the foundation of which these policies, obviously, of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, and as given by him, were based. It is true that Amir al-Mu'mineen used to say that, you know, from your life I have only two loaves and two pieces of clothes. It's true that Amir al-Mu'mineen was, you know, giving advice to companions that you should seek, an easier life. But that wasn't the message, though. Now, let us take a short break, then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam. When we look at the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam, he himself, he lived a very simple life. In fact, sometimes it's a harsher life. And so did his close companions and close disciples. Now, is that the same message that the Umayyad dynasty, for example, or those before the Imam or after the Imam, were pushing to people that you should live a life of simplicity and harshness and don't indulge in selfish desires and pleasures because, you know, God forbid, you could be, you know, going to hell, while the kings and the rulers themselves get richer day by day and indulge in their entertainment and their whatever they're doing? Oh, no. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, because this is a very big topic, I can't go in detail. With Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, when he was treating himself harshly, because he was in a position of leadership, he himself had to endure, and he has to go through what the lowest people in his government might go through in terms of poverty and in terms of clothing and in terms of house. If Amir al-Mu'mineen as a ruler had a better food or a better house or better clothes than any of his subjects, any of his citizens, then he would not be a fair leader. Therefore, first and foremost, is an obligation of Amir al-Mu'mineen that he should live a simple life, that no one under his government can come and say, "Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, I am poor, I don't have food," while you as a Khalifa, as a king, indulging yourself. So when Amir al-Mu'mineen dressed in a certain way or ate in a certain way, he does not want me and you to live poverty, to not work, to not earn, to not enjoy life. On the contrary, many times people try to do this, and the, you know, their relatives would complain to Amir al-Mu'mineen, and Amir al-Mu'mineen would tell them off. He said, "This is not your life." And even when he talks about himself, he says, "Your imam, you know, he had two of this, two of that. That was enough for him. I know you can't do this." He does say, he said, "I know you cannot do such a thing that I'm doing, because it's not your position. But you can have taqwa, you can have piety, you can have such and such." With his disciples, with his, you know, the saints of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, for them it was self-purification. Not that they did not earn, not that they did not work. Each one of them had a trade. Each one of them was working. Each one of them was earning. And they were putting their money in their place. But they themselves, in order to train themselves, they had to deprive themselves of certain acts that is a willingly from their own. So we can't compare what the Umayyad dynasty, for example, were pushing the agenda that you should live a simple life and putting people into poverty, and Amir al-Mu'mineen's agenda, where he's trying to say, actually, no, on the contrary, you need to work, you need to earn, you have the right to live a happy, prosperous life. But if you want to reform yourself, that's a different issue, considering that you have what you need. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. 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 Salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. with the light.
The Indian administered Kashmir has the world's only floating post office, a 200-year-old houseboat on a famous Dal Lake in Srinagar. Set up during the British rule in India, the post office has survived throughout the years because of its charm. Our correspondent Shahana Bhatt has more.
The Indian-administered Kashmir was once a princely independent state, out of bounds for outsiders. As the ruler of Jammu and Kashmir disallowed non-locals to own property in this picturesque region. During the British rule in the Indian subcontinent, many Britons tried to find an alternative way of living in Kashmir. Thus, houseboat on the world-famous Dal Lake came into existence. Today, the lake is a home to hundreds of such boats, which are a major attraction for tourists around the globe. This one is a unique boat, the only floating post office in the whole world. This is a 200-year-old boat built by the British. It has truly stood the test of time, as it still functions.
Post office, Dal Lake.
This is not an ordinary post office. We're standing on a heritage property. I've enjoyed my work since the very first day I came here. It's a unique experience to be working here, and every day I get the chance to meet people from different corners of the world.
The boat is not limited to postal services. It also has a small museum where colorful stamps from the 1980s are put to display, along with a collection of rare Philately stamps. The post office is a hot tourist destination in the region. Locals also come to this post office to send postcards to their loved ones, inviting them to visit Kashmir.
Floating post office.
In the age of technology, electronic mails, e-cards and other internet applications have made it extremely easy for people to communicate. But sending a postcard from this floating post office gives one a really different feeling.
The floating post office underwent reconstruction in 2011 and is currently a part of the Indian postal system. Recently, the office started offering banking services, thus attracting more locals.
I have opened an account here for my daughter. It's hassle-free and this place suits my mind. It's not like the usual offices. Visiting this place with kids is like a trip.
Yet another attraction of this post office is this souvenir shop, from where everyone can buy postcards, stamps, traditional crafts and greeting cards.
This floating post office in Kashmir's Dal Lake is like a time machine. It brings people back to 2 centuries ago and shows them the history of the beautiful region. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Turtles get a second chance to spread their fins after being found with bellies full of plastic. They were rescued and are now being released back to the sea in Argentina. Two green turtles and four loggerhead turtles were saved from fishing nets in Buenos Aires province. The group was taken to Grupo Marina Foundation, where they recuperated after purging 10 types of plastic from their bodies. Rehabilitation of the turtles lasted over a month and included blood tests and other procedures to make sure they were free of plastic. A biologist with a foundation says the danger of plastic is that it's silent and usually its dangers are so gradual that it goes unnoticed.
Many times the animal appears to be in perfect health. However, during the checkup and evaluation, we found a large amount of this material inside. So it is important to get rid of the plastic before the condition worsens and it ends up causing the deaths of the specimens.
The turtles had mistakenly eaten plastic, thinking it was food. Wind, waves, and sunshine break down discarded plastic into tiny pieces, which litter ocean waters. Much of this plastic waste can be found on beds of seaweed that turtles forage for food. This trash ends up fatally clogging their bellies, causing the decline in the population of this graceful reptile. Now Now let's go to Germany to hear the heartwarming story of how technology is turning a young boy's life around. 7-year-old Joshua has a severe lung disease which has made him unable to go to school. But now he can attend his classes from home with the help of an avatar robot. The device sits in Joshua's Berlin classroom, enabling him to listen to the classroom in real time to what his teacher and classmates are saying. Joshua can even interact with everyone else by making the robot display a blinking signal.
Each year, a village in Vietnam becomes awash in red and orange as it gears up for the Lunar New Year with spectacular mass production of incense. January is usually the busiest time when villagers are dyeing, drying and whittling bamboo bark to make the fragrance sticks. Also, the scent of each batch is carefully tailored to suit the tastes of the regions where they will be sold. Most households here are involved in this ancient trade, and sales are a major part of their livelihoods. The Lunar New Year will begin on the first day of February. Around this time, sales tick up with throngs of people crowding into temples to light incense during worship. A 3-year-old girl from China's Hebei province has astonished ski enthusiasts with her impressive snowboarding talent.
Hello everybody, I'm Wang Xixi. I'm 3 years old and I can snowboard now.
Xixi's skills have attracted a lot of attention as a toddler boldly tackles the slopes. She makes snowboarding look easy. Despite her tender age, she is already taming the slopes at a higher skill level than a number of other aspiring snowboarders. Her parents say she has been practicing for less than 2 weeks and her progress is startling.
I remember several years ago, I felt quite scared when I was on the advanced slope, but a mother told me that Xixi started to snowboard down right when she got to the advanced trail. She was not afraid at all.
Her parents say she quickly grasped the snowboarding movements and techniques, including some of the trickier swivels and turns. They say Xixi is enjoying the progress she is making on the slopes, and every chance she gets, she asks to go snowboarding. The young snowboarder's mum says the hobby has also brought the family closer together as they enjoy a shared passion together.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The chronic shortage of human organs has always been an issue for patients, especially those suffering from heart diseases. But now a major scientific breakthrough is in the making. U.S. surgeons have successfully implanted a heart from a genetically modified pig into a man. Doctors had said the patient, 57-year-old, was unable to have human transplant because of his health conditions. But now he is recovering from his latest surgery. The surgeons say the man is being carefully monitored to determine how the new organ is performing. But for those who want to know why pigs, here is why. Pigs are considered ideal donors because of their size and rapid growth, among other things.
You know, it is a game changer because, now we will have these organs readily available if this works. And, and I hope it will work. We'll have these organs available. We can, we have the technique of genetically modifying. So if there are more tweaking required for modifying the genes, we will be able to do that, and can customize basically the heart for or the organ for the patient.
The transplant is the first of its kind in the world and follows years of research. In the U.S. alone, about 110,000 people are currently waiting for an organ transplant. Also, more than 6,000 patients die each year before getting one. A kingdom of ice and snow. Don't be surprised, it's an international sculpture festival held annually in the Chinese city of Harbin. This year the venue brims with sports elements in a runner-up to the 2022 Winter Olympics scheduled in Beijing. The annual Winter Festival is the largest of its kind, where sculptors spend weeks using ice and snow to create structures under a given theme. The upcoming Winter Games is the theme this year, as one can visualize giant statues of Bing Duanduan. The adorable panda mascots are major attractions of the exhibition. The chief designer says an ice tower standing in the center of the park features 24 vertical structures, referring to the 24th Winter Olympics.
In terms of the design concept, the sculpture features 24 vertical structures, referring to the 24th Winter Olympics to be held in Beijing. The spiral array form also indicated the proactive spirit of the Olympics. The free and upward effect is a vivid presentation of the Olympic flame.
The annual festival, which is being held for about 3 decades, usually attracts domestic and foreign tourists. But COVID-19 restrictions have limited the crowds over the past couple of years. Harbin is located in northeast China and receives cold winter wind from Siberia. An average winter temperature there is around minus 17 degrees Celsius.
South Koreans enjoy a wildlife refuge near the Korean Demilitarized Zone. New tours opened in November from the DMZ Crane Peace Town. Frank Smith has more in this report.
A new hiking trail and birdwatching facility opened up in South Korea this past November. DMZ Crane Peace Town created special birding cabins and guides wilderness hikes north of the 38th parallel, near the DMZ, the fortified border with North Korea. The Demilitarized Zone was created with the armistice that ended the Korean War back in 1953. Guard post fencing and a 2 to 4 kilometer wide buffer zone now separate North Korea and South Korea, with that no man's land becoming home to rejuvenated plant and wildlife. Local officials see wildlife tourism as an opportunity to promote inter-Korean peace.
Cranes know no borders. That's why we're promoting the crane as a symbol of peace, as they can freely come and go between North and South Korea.
Each winter, several species of birds, especially cranes, spend time to rest and feed in the area, where there's little development and few people. Officials say more birds have been coming here because of depleted feeding grounds in the north.
Shirwan has wide plains suitable for growing rice. Cranes eat the grain that has fallen after harvest, and it's the best place for cranes because it's located north of the civilian control line.
A safe vantage point to photograph the wildlife is provided at the Hantan River near Yangji Village, attracting birders from far afield.
I left home at 4 in the morning to come here to photograph wild birds, swans and cranes. It's good because there are many mallard ducks and other birds. They fight for food.